Accession number 20117, Reel 4.
Richard Hill, Reel 4.
Fine. We decided that the only sensible thing to do now would be to return to Gold Beach. There was no point in just firing in the direction of land because our ammunition was becoming restricted. We had enough, but we certainly couldn't afford just to spray it in the hope of hitting something, because we didn't know how long they were going to keep us there or what sort of tasks they might ask us to do. So we went back to the main beach, and we went to a control ship. I think it was called DeSoag or something, but it was a big ML that had obviously to guide and marshal and allot tasks to the landing craft rather than to ourselves. And we told him who we were, and he said, well, there's nothing we want you for at the moment. He said, we're far too preoccupied with the problems here. Go out to sea, find a ship, and get them to agree to allow you to make fast against them for the night. Because with a little craft, we haven't got the anchor length of rope. We can't anchor out at sea. And anyway, what he did say, he said, and the weather forecast is bad, which it was. So we did what he wanted us to do, but quite frankly, you could see the beach there because we weren't all that far out. And I didn't want to go out into all the craft that was still coming in, you know, pouring in fact. So I was going to go back to my flank, I call it my flank, and then go out that way, because I knew there were ships lying off, LCGs and LCFs and that, you know, flak ships and rocket ships and things like that, and I thought it's no good going to the Ajax. So anyway, we had a look at the beach, and I say it seemed absolute pandemonium. There were craft all over the place and tanks smashed up on the sand of the beach, and it just went on and on like that. But anyhow, then we turned out and we went to sea, and we saw an LCG, a landing ship gun, which is a great big long craft. You know, it's a long craft, and normally it would carry tanks, two or three tanks in it, and it's capable of beaching and ramping. But it was an adaptation of one of those, rather like our craft was an adaptation of an LCA. And they put three big guns in, which could fire, you know, whether they were 4-inch, 6-inches, I don't know, but they were big guns, and the whole craft had been reinforced, obviously, to take the impact on firing of that sort of thing. And we hailed them, and we went alongside them, and to my surprise, the gunnery officer was a chap called Brian Cook, whom I met as an officer. I didn't know where he went. I met him earlier on in my career in Marines, probably on a course or something. And we were delighted to meet each other. I told him my problem, and I said, we shipped a lot of water, and I really do want to make sure that we can locate what it is. Can you help us? And he said, we'll give you all the help you like. And I said, can we stay the night to berth to you, or can we fix a line and lie astern? He said, no, come alongside. He said, we'll feed your lads. We can, if you're happy, we'll take them in and let them sleep. He said, but I'd rather you left, you know, the stoker and the coxswain and yourself on your own craft. Can you sleep on that? And I said, oh yes, thanks, Brian, we can. Don't worry there. You see, we have no toilets, food, cooking, or anything on the craft like that. It's just guns, ammunition, and 9-10 crew, you see. So we did that, and I went and slept down in the stokehole, that's the warm part, to sleep. And the coxswain moved into the turret, and anyhow, three of us stayed aboard. So if anything had happened, we could have got the craft, you know, moving in a flash. And they gave us a breakfast, and they also contacted the powers that be off Beach DeSoag, I presume, again. And they told us that They wanted us to lay smoke from Arromanches through Port Ambassan along the coast, but not to go into the Omaha area. I suppose for obvious reasons, they were probably still in the middle of everything, I don't know. And that's what we did. And then it was about, it was after midday, I know. We thought, well, we do need more ammunition if we're to do anything worthwhile. We hadn't used any on the next morning at all. And we certainly need more smoke canisters if we can get them. So I went back again to the main beach, and this time they said, well, that's it, thank you very much, your task's done. Well done sort of idea. Now go back to the loading area, and there's bound to be an LSI there bringing troops over from Southampton. And he said, as soon as you see one that looks as though it's about to leave, he said, hail them and get them to hoist you, and you go back to the UK. And we went back, and the boat that was there was the old Arquebus, amongst others. So we went, and they knew us, and, you know, they hoisted us, and that was it. And I can't remember any celebrations with my lads, but the three I am now in touch with after 50 years, so they may like me have doubts and memories, but they said they were so thankful to be alive. He said, you've no idea how proud we were. He said, to have come back and come out alive. He said, we all felt, you know, we were going to go for good, get killed. And he said, he said, we wished you'd come down. And I said, well, I can't remember what I was doing, but I'm sorry I wasn't down too, but still there we are. And that was it. So they took us back to the UK. We were then hoisted again, or I think we were hoisted again, maybe in the Arquebus still, and we were taken up to the Clyde. They dropped our ships, our craft at the Clyde, and they took us to, and we were sent to one of the Clyde assembly points near a shipyard, and we decommissioned the boat there. And we went to the naval, we always went to naval in the landing, Blueberry side. And they said, you ought to go down to a big transit camp in Westcliff on sea. And, but he said, as of this moment, you're being paid off. And that's exactly what it is, which is a pity because the LCA flotilla always kept together. And we were going to be required again very shortly, we didn't know that then. And because of that, I lost contact with them. And you know, when you're 20, you don't have a vision to think, I really ought to take their name and address, and we ought to do this. Now, strange enough, some of them did that between themselves, which I think was rather wonderful and very lucky from my point of view.
What was the number of your craft?
Well, now, there's the point. That's one of the things we cannot remember. I've asked everyone. I've even asked 524 LCA flotilla, who kept very good records of it. I'm hoping that this chap, Ivor Howcroft, will help me there.
So what happened next?
Well, next I went to Westcliff. It was and the camp consisted of all the hotels along the front of Westcliff. God knows whether they went as far as Southend or what. But it really was a vast transit camp run by the Navy. And I was there, I think, for about 3 or 4 weeks, and I became very restless because I was desperate to get back, and I still hankered after this appointment with the commanders because I felt I did want to be a commander. I got friendly with a naval lieutenant there who was on the staff, and I always remember, and this made my mind up once and for all, he said to me, you know, Richard, he said, you can spend the rest of the war in this place. He said, no one probably knows you're here. And he said, it's a nice number. And I said, well, I don't want to stay here, Laurie. I said, it's the last thing I want. I said, much as I enjoy your company. And they had parties in the evening. It was more like a holiday in a 5-star hotel, you know, for the officers anyway. And I said, much as I enjoy your company and all the entertainment and that, I said, I really do want to get back. So there's no distance from Westcliff to Queen Anne's Gate where the Royal Marine Office went. So I went there. Finally got an appointment with a captain who seemed not too helpful about things. He said, well, don't worry, we'll find something for you. And I said, well, I would love to have a flotilla of my own if I'm to remain with these. I said, but if I can't have a my own, I'd like to go to Aknakari. It's a 6-week course and perhaps be, you know, pass as a commander and go in as a replacement, you know, because I knew the commanders had suffered badly all along the peace. And remember, Waltron hadn't even happened then. And he said, well, I'll deal with it. He said, I've got your name, and he did scribble it down on a pad. And I got back, and almost immediately I was sent to a course at a place called HMS Cook, Tina Bruick. I don't know if you've heard of it. I'd never heard of it. I couldn't even find it on the map now. I'm sure I could if I'd looked properly. But it was up in the Cowles of Bute. And it was night navigation for landing craft. And again, I stirred things up a bit, and I said, I just can't understand this. I said, you know, I've done landing craft, I've come back from Normandy, and I said, I don't know why you want me to do night navigation, because I'm hoping to be posted to the commanders. But it didn't matter, because simultaneously with that, an order came through, telegram, I hadn't even finished the course, telling me to report immediately to Richborough Wharf. That's just off Pegwell Bay and near Ramsgate and Deal, where a new LCSM flotilla was being formed. So I did this with great alacrity. I got off on the next ferry when it came in and got back to Glasgow and down to Richborough Wharf. And sure enough, they were forming this flotilla. Now, it was very different to anything we'd had in Normandy, in as much as this was a flotilla of 12 craft, of 12 officers who reported to a CO, whereas Normandy intended to be an independent command. And with the flotilla went a naval engineering section with engineers and chippies and one thing and t'other, all to do with the maintenance of the craft. And about 100 Royal Marines, and I think it was 6 naval radio telegraphers. So I thought, oh, this sounds interesting. But then I had become interested in LCSMs, and of course I was very proud to have been on an LCSM. I was always proud to be a Royal Marine. But I thought, well, this does sound interesting. I think I'm going to see how this goes. And well, the unit was only semi-formed then, but the craft were all moored at Richborough Wharf, and it began to make sense, because as we gathered ratings and crew gangs together, so they were allotted to a craft, and so we started to do exercises with the craft, and our exercises were always pretty well the same, and we had to do them in all weathers, even though we weren't a complete flotilla, it was still being formed. And we had to sail out to from Richborough Wharf is on a sort of, well, it's like a river, I think that's all, and it goes into Pegwell Bay, and Pegwell Bay is very sandy where it comes out the estuary. I think you can walk across it when it's low water. But almost every night that it was possible to get out, we had to go out, and in all weathers, and it could be very rough in Pegwell Bay. And I couldn't see the sense of this, but we just had to go out there, do a circle or two in Pegwell Bay, and then come back, and they wanted us back by a certain time always, or not later than. That's presumably because of the tides, but it had other repercussions as well eventually. And then the flotilla was formed. By then, the big naval flotilla with the special shallow boat gunships which had been in Ramsgate Harbour and round there, had sailed, and we knew that Waltron had taken place. The Royal Marine, 4th Royal Marine Special Services Brigade had taken Waltron. And I'll come back to that in a moment too. And we followed out, and we were taken in a large ship, and as I recall it, we sailed into the ship and the doors closed, and it took us to Ostend, and they put us in the submarine pens there. We had a CO whom I didn't see at that stage. I mean, I knew him, but I didn't see, he didn't come over with us, as far as I know. We got into these submarine pens, and I was told to make my way to a hotel, which was a naval officer's hotel. And I went there, and quick, the captain was there, and he said, "You're to marshal the whole flotilla." He obviously didn't know where we were, because he said, "Are you all in the submarine pens?" And I said, "Yes, we are." He said, "And you're to take them to Terneuzen." Now, Terneuzen's a town halfway, you know, I didn't tell you about that for the sake, is a town halfway down the Scheldt, which has only just been opened. And he said, "Assemble them there, and we'll be briefed as to our further tasks." Well, we got there. We sailed along the Channel Coast. I seem to recall we went into a canal, whether it was the Ghent Canal, I don't know. We went up the canal and we got to Neusen. But there is a variation of this. Other people say we didn't do it that way. That we went to Breskens, which is right opposite Flushing, and went down to Neusen that way. But my memory fails me on this one, but we got there anyway. And we did have a briefing in a sort of village hall place. And the story we got was from, again, I think this time it was an army officer and a naval officer, that with the failure of Arnhem, which is an airborne operation, the commander brigade had been told to capture Walcheren. And Walcheren had taken place on the 1st of November, and I think they had 10,000, 48 commander tell me this, 10,500 men on Walcheren, and these enormous guns, which were suicide to take, that commanded the entrance to the Scheldt. So we had the Scheldt there, but we couldn't get into it. And the big value of the Scheldt was that when Arnhem failed, we did have, thanks to the 11th Armoured Brigade, one good port that we could really count on and really would mean something to the Allies, because all the others had been sabotaged or weren't big enough along the, you know, the Calais, the Ostend, well, Ostend, yes, and that. And but they had Antwerp intact, but they couldn't use it until the brigade opened it up. And whoever thought of sending me on a night navigation course had their wits about them, obviously. And had anticipated this particular operation. Arnhem having failed, they had opened they had already opened the Scheldt, and Antwerp now, it wasn't open then, there were still too many sunken craft and mines and that. Antwerp was going to be the main port for the big push in spring, or as soon as the weather was sufficiently acceptable for them to start moving tanks over grounds and rolling into Germany. And that because of the Scheldt, the Scheldt was really the border between the two armies before. We had the South Bank, you know, with Ostend and these places, but the Germans held the islands, and that went right up to Bergen op Zoom, but certainly into the Maas anyway, which, is a bit, which went through Germany, is the border between Germany and Holland, I believe. And therefore the front line had been moved from the Scheldt to the Oosterscheldt and the Maas. And they said that there were two possibilities here. One was that there was a rumour that Rundstedt still had a hankering to try and come back and capture Antwerp, in which case he might be moving troops over from the lines he was now pinned back to, thanks to the fall of Walcheren and North Beveland. And the other reason was, they said that now that the Germans haven't got the Scheldt, they may make use of the Oosterscheldt to hide craft there and to raid us and to sort of see, you know, how strongly held. And we weren't strongly held. The commander brigade held from the tip of Walcheren right up to the Maas and into the Maas. And that wasn't very many men to hold a line for 4 or 5 months, which is what it meant. And if the Germans did know that, they might well have tried something. But that's what they told us. So they said the Germans might make use of this, and we don't want this to be done. We've got to have it patrolled, and we've got to make sure that the Germans know that we are about. And your task, they said, not to me as such, but to the unit, is to move up to Wemeldinger, and from thence you can stay on the South Beveren ship canal behind lock gates, this is what they'd all planned out for us, with your craft, but every night you've got to go out and patrol the waterway between the German-held islands of Skaren and Overflakkie and the banks of the Maas, and you've got to intercept anything that you see there, because at Rotterdam we know there are 50 E-boats. We also know that there are a new explosive type of boat, which is manned by, I think, yes, manned by one man. And there are miniature submarines, which all could be used for torpedoing shipping coming into the River Scheldt on its way to Antwerp. So we wanted to deny them of that facility. So we moved up just as they said the next day. We went up the ship canal and we came to Wemeldinger. It had obviously been the scene of quite a lot of activity and being taken by the Canadian army, but the lock gates were intact. And they were ideal shelter, and I have a picture which will show you the layout there. The idea was that we formed two watches of 6 craft each, making up the 12. We never quite implemented that because we always held 2 in reserve in case of engine trouble and things like that. But we were in 2 watches, and we were told we had to go out every night irrespective of the weather. And this must be patrolled, and the Germans must be made cognizant of our presence there, so that they didn't use it for any of these other purposes. But equally, we were not to lose any craft, we were not to risk any craft, and neither were we to risk life. They said, your orders are to patrol, you're not to get engaged or fight battles, we don't want loss of life or craft. I think they put it the other way, I think they put the craft first. So anyway, we got to Wemeldinger. We had 2 or 3 days. It was all very rushed to sort ourselves out. So we managed to requisition 2 schools, which we made into quarters for the men. And we had our own kitchens in this case, and we didn't have any medical or padre facilities. But we had these engineers with us, and we were fairly self-contained. And the men were fairly comfortable. I mean, they were in the schools and they were able to sort of sling their hammocks or their ground sheets and what have you, but they were undercover. Unfortunately, the Germans had sealed the outlet pipe from a stove in one of the schools. They had these big round stoves, rather like we had in our army, with a pipe that went up into the ceiling, you know, to warm the place, and it was bitterly cold by then, incidentally. And they had concreted the top of that into the loft, and our men lit the fire, and of course the whole place went up and was burnt down, the school, the first night. Luckily we hadn't put any things like ammunition or too much gear in there, but when we salvaged everything, so we were okay, and the craft were completely separate and safe. But we had to relocate those. And the idea was that these 6 craft would go out as soon as it was dark. We couldn't go out before dark because the Germans would see us coming, you know, and would be able to fire at us with their machine guns and other guns. And the idea was to go out and patrol those waters, and in the fullness of time they asked us to, you know, arouse the Germans by firing at where we thought or where we'd been told they were gun emplacements. There was always a lot of activity there with flares, mostly from the German side, so they knew we were there, and they could actually have taken pot shots of us at night, I always felt, although we didn't expose ourselves in the narrow part of the waters unless we had to, because at one stage the crossing was very short. It was only about 3/4 of a mile at one end and tapered to about 1/4, then it opened out again, and then it went down on another waterway to Remeldinger where we were. So I got deputed, I suppose, because I had been on this so-called night navigation course to take out the first sortie. And we had no charts. We hadn't really studied the waters at all. We didn't know what they were like. We had been warned by the Navy that it was extremely tricky because the tidal races were fast and the sandbanks were many, but that there were channels. Once we found these channels, all should be well. And as far as they knew, there were no obstructions, no underwater obstructions or anything like that to contend with. Because it was about a 40-minute run from the lock gates, once we'd opened those, to Wemeldinger. And we used to have to go up the side of North Beveland and part of South Beveland, which bulged out. And then we hit the waterway of the Oosterscheldt, which went up, as I say, into the mast of the two islands of Skarn and Overflecke. So I felt very uncomfortable and complete lack of confidence. So I got one of the crewmen to stand on the bow with a lead and just sound our way. And we went out very cautiously and silently. And I must say, it was an eerie experience going into something you didn't know what to expect or what you were going to find. And you didn't know what was waiting for you on the water or anything like that. It was a very eerie experience. And when I thought back to Normandy, you know, with all the tremendous support you felt you were going from the air, the charts you had, and all these other aids, here we had to sort of literally feel our way forward, and we did just that. And I didn't like it, because one moment you'd be getting a good sounding, because our draft was only 2'4" forward, you know, and say 3 foot aft, so we were pretty safe by and large, but you didn't want to get stranded on a falling tide on one of these sandbanks, because you'd be in terrible trouble then. And we never were as a flotilla, as far as I know. Well, we were, but luckily saved by another factor, which I'll come to. Anyway, sorry about that. We were getting to what I felt was the main channel, which is our area of patrol, when suddenly we saw a shape looming ahead. So we dropped three of the craft back, which is a normal procedure, and they sort of took their stations, and three of us went forward and round, and it was a magnificent yacht, a two-master. I mean, it had gangways, you know, and it had living quarters and everything like that, and we didn't know what to make of this. We hadn't been told about this, and it was anchored, and it was between two waters and a sort of promontory thing. So we went round, we went aboard it very, very cautiously and searched it, and it was empty, and as far as we could see without breaking things down, there was no evidence of anyone having used it, you know. No cigarette cartons or anything like that. So we got off that pretty quickly. We took note of it, of course, of where it was. And we went back to the main channel and started again approaching this. And we suddenly came across another great big dark looming shape. And this was a boy, a very big boy too. And it was clanging away rather sinisterly, not loudly, but making this noise as we got nearer. So we again went to that and just circled it. And it's just as well that it was there, because that saved us on many a time to be able to tell us exactly where we were. So at least I could now...